welcome to Books on the Go, a podcast where we talk about our book of the week. I'm Anna Bailey-Karras and I'm here with Amanda Hayes. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Anna.
And this week we're doing a special episode of our top wellness books, and we're going to cover lots of topics and be very healthy this morning. So let's get started. We won't even worry about book news. We'll just jump straight into it because we have so many great books to cover. Amanda is especially qualified for this episode and I'm not, but that's okay. because Amanda, apart from being a lawyer, you have also...
I have a master's in nutrition. And I will say just quickly, it's a fairly new science in the world of sciences. So there's a lot that we are still discovering, which is one of the reasons why I think nutrition can be a little bit confusing. But we've got some books that will help you in that area.
But it's also exciting that they're making these new discoveries. And in some senses, the discoveries is really the science showing us or proving to us things that we sort of knew.
I think that's absolutely right, going back to basics.
Yeah, but understanding why the basics work, I suppose. And also Amanda has another podcast on.
Yes, I do.
And that's all about wellness. So that's Amanda's Wellbeing Podcast. Yes. Yes, so you can check that out as well. And you interview people, don't you?
I do. I interview people in relation to anything related to well-being, so in relation to nutrition, physical health and mental health. Plus I do a little 5-minute food facts segment where I'll pick a topic like sugar, for example, and just present some factual information about that and recent research.
So speaking of nutrition, we'll start with that. We're going to cover nutrition, sleep and rest, exercise and movement, and mental health and social connections. So we'll start with nutrition. So we're really covering a lot of bases today. In nutrition, we've got two books that we're recommending, but we would love your tips as well and your recommendations. So do email us or let us know what are your favourite wellbeing books. The first one I think we'll talk about, one of my favourites, is Food Rules by Michael Pollan. And so Amanda, you've read this as well, haven't you?
Yes.
And he's written a few books, but this is the only one that I've read that where he does talk about various elements of food and eating. He's a journalist, so he comes to this completely open-minded and just wants to research, you know, what should we be eating. And the tagline or the takeaway message from this book is eat food, mostly plants, not too much. So it's very easy to grasp. And what I loved about this book was that he goes through different elements of our diet and how to eat and what we should eat and why, but he's a very good communicator, so it's really easy to follow, really engaging, and it's just sensible. And so
So he presents, it's called Food Rules, so he presents, I guess, in quotes, rules about how we should eat, and they're very simple, but the thing is they're backed by a lot of science, but he hasn't bogged the book down with all of that. So some of the rules, for example, are things like eat food. And by that he means real actual food.
Yes. And does that mean, Amanda, instead of something like a juice or a smoothie, do you think? Is it part of that, the chewing and the actual eating?
Well, I personally think so, because, for example, with a juice you're stripping away the fibre and you're if you eat, for example, one orange, you're getting all the fibre that goes with it and I guess the calories of one orange, whereas if you have a glass of orange juice, you're having about maybe 4 oranges in a huge hit of sugar into your system. And drinking is not satiating either, because the chemical messages in your stomach don't register that feeling of fullness. Yes. So, you know, you can drink a huge amount of juice or soft drink or anything sweet, which adds a lot of energy into your diet, but not really anything that's good for you.
It doesn't fill you up for a long time. But he has some great rules. So, yes, as you say, eating food, there's things like don't eat anything your great-grandmother wouldn't recognise as food. Mm. So if you pick up a little yogurt tube or eat something with 15 ingredients that you can't pronounce, ask yourself, what are those things doing there?
So, yeah. And the other thing, one of my favourites, is avoid foods that are pretending to be something they're not. So in that, he's really referring to margarine instead of butter.
Yes.
So he basically, it's knowledge that I think we know. It's eat real food, don't eat processed food, eat basic things and eat them with joy and mindfulness.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's why this book appealed to me, because it's very common sense stuff and it doesn't make you change your diet or go on a crazy fad thing of just eating celery all day or whatever. And one of the other of my favourite of the rules was eat meat. He talks about meat and he says historically we are carnivores and so eating meat is okay, but he says for our well-being and our health and our digestive system and all of these other reasons, just eat a little bit. And he says eat meat as flavour.
Yes.
So in other words, on your plate, if you need that flavour, have a little bit of, you know, crispy pancetta or a little bit of steak, or if you'd been ethical about it, you would say eat the whole animal, don't just cut one bit of steak and then there's such wastage associated with that. But eat a small amount as flavour, but mostly have vegetables on that plate. And it's I really like that. That's a nice balance.
It's the way Asians eat, I think.
Yeah.
The meat is, it's not the it's not front and centre of the meal. As you say, it's flavour and it's almost reversing, I guess, the typical US diet where they'll have a huge chunk of meat and a few sad-looking vegetables around the edge. And it's sort of saying it should be the other way around, like mainly vegetables, lots of fibre and vitamins and minerals. And, yes, a bit of meat. It's a great source of protein and flavour, but you don't need a huge amount.
No, so I really loved it. And this is a few years ago that it was published, and I wonder what he would make of all the movement now for those meat substitutes where you have the Impossible Burger, which is not meat but it looks like a real burger, and because they put the beetroot juice it bleeds and all of
that. I'm not really a fan of that stuff because it is highly, highly processed. I guess there's a reason. I mean, for some people who for whatever reason don't want to eat meat, maybe an ethical reason, I guess that's where it's going in the market. But I don't know, if you look at the ingredients, it's usually they kind of do chemical things with soy products and I don't know how healthy it all is.
No, well, that's where I'm for it in the sense that I think we all should be eating less meat, and I think that is where the world needs to go.
Yeah.
But for environmental reasons, apart from anything else, but if it was just me, I would say, well, why not just eat vegetables and whatever else you need in the diet rather than pretend to be eating meat.
So,
you know, again, easy for me to say if we've got lots of options where we live, but I do find it a bit absurd.
Yes.
But on the other hand, if that's better than eating too much meat, as for which as an aggregate we all do, then I guess that's better than the alternative.
It's tricky, isn't it?
Yeah, it is interesting. It'd be fun to see him update the book with all of
those. Speaking of the absurd, I'll just quickly say I've been reading another book about the diet, and one of the things, it's an American-based book, and they were talking about how French cheeses have a lot of mold and bacteria growing on them, which accounts for the flavour, and how in the US that they don't really recommend eating that kind of cheese, and instead they promote that very highly processed sort of sterile style of cheese. And the author says, so microbes and bacteria have been deemed way too dangerous for Americans, yet firearms are not.
Yeah, I know.
So it can all get a bit absurd, I think, sometimes.
It can be, yeah. And he says just a nice thing about eating together around the table if you can, and enjoy your meals. And also, this is one of my favourites, don't buy food where you buy your gasoline. And he says in the US, 20% of food is eaten in the car.
Oh, really?
But I don't know how accurate that is, but that's a figure that I don't know how they would get those figures. But anyhow, so that's Food Rules by Michael Pollan. And you've got another one, Non-Nutrition,
yes,
Amanda, which I've been meaning to read and I still haven't. And so I'm glad you're mentioning this one.
Well, this is a book called Gut, The Inside Story of Our Body's Most Underrated Organ by Julia Enders. It's been translated from German. And she wrote this while she was a medical student because she was surprised at how little time they spent learning about the gut, which is one of the most important organs in our body. And there's a lot of research coming out in the last decade or so about it's called the gut-brain axis, or how your brain and your gut actually talk to each other, and your gut is like a second brain. And so she looks at the function of the gut and, very importantly, how to keep it healthy. Mm. And because in our gut there are trillions, I think, of different kinds of bacteria. In fact, I think there are more bacteria than cells in our body. Mm. They all have a different function. And if we don't treat them well, like if we take too many antibiotics and kill them off, or we eat highly processed food, we're not actually feeding them.
Mm.
And so high fiber foods are great food that the bacteria breaks down and then uses the short chain fatty acids that it produces as their own fuel. So she talks about how to keep your gut healthy and how that can impact your immunity.
Yes.
And also the other thing that I think we all know intuitively is you really feel things in your gut. You know, if you're scared or nervous, you can feel it in your gut. So
there's definitely a connection with the brain, isn't there?
It puts the science in there. We know those things, but there's a reason for them.
Yeah. It's so fascinating.
And diversity is really key, I think, in the diet. And eating prebiotics and probiotics, so things like yogurts. And
do you eat the kimchi sort of things?
Sauerkraut and kimchi, occasionally.
Mm. Like fermented foods.
Fermented foods.
That's the other thing. There's been a fad for the fermented foods, and you can get a bit lost with all these. Well, now should I eat fermented foods, or was I meant to be eating, you know, blueberries or something?
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. I think, as you said, diversity really is. A bit of fermented food here and there is going to be good for you, but you don't need to sort of, you know, immerse yourself in it.
Yeah. Oh, good. So that's Gut by Julia Enders. And she's also given, I think, some TED Talks on that,
hasn't she?
She's a good speaker.
And I will say that there are quite a few books on this topic these days. But this is a nice one because I think it's written with the reader in mind.
Yes.
It's well explained. It's clear.
Yeah.
It's easy to read.
Yeah, I think that's important. Well, certainly for me, because I have no science training. So I really appreciate a book when you can tell that the author is a good communicator,
yes,
as well as understanding the science. So that brings me to our next segment. Speaking of good communicators, we are now talking about sleep and rest. And the first one is Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker. And I'm quite evangelical about this book, so I could actually talk about this for hours, Amanda, which we won't do. But this is a book about sleep, and Matthew Walker's a sleep scientist based in the States, but I think he's English, and he's just a very good communicator apart from anything else. So what I have done, apart from reading into the book, and I sort of dipped in and out of it, which you can do, especially with nonfiction. Mm. I think that's a nice way to do it. But I also typed into my podcast app his name, Matthew Walker, and it came up with an interview he gave on another podcast called Found My Fitness, where they talked about this for 2 hours, not kidding. And he is so enthusiastic and so engaging to listen to that it just hooked me in completely. So that's another way of accessing all the information in a more conversational way for people who don't have time to read or who just want to get another element. This is sort of the blurb. Scientists have discovered a revolutionary new treatment that makes you live longer. It enhances your memory, makes you more attractive, it keeps you slim and lowers food cravings. It protects you from cancer and dementia. It wards off colds and flu. It lowers your risk of heart attacks and stroke, not to mention diabetes. You'll feel happier, less depressed, and less anxious. Are you interested? How can you resist that? But anyhow, look, it goes without saying, it's the benefits of sleep. It's, again, something that we know, and you might think, well, I already know that. So yes, thank you for the reminder. I'll try to get more sleep. But I found what motivated me to change some of my habits, mm-hmm. which this book did, was understanding the benefits, because when you understand all the things that the good things that sleep does for your brain, your body, your immune system, you want to go to bed that yes. little bit earlier because you actually want to. And the fun thing about sleep, or compared to diets and exercise, and or exercise is a bit like this too, but the fun thing about sleep is you see the benefit the next day.
Yes.
So it's immediate payoff. And so, you know, that's enticing as well. And exercise I would put in that category, to be fair. Yes. So some of my highlights were he goes back to basics and talks about your sleep cycles. And so in any sleep cycle, you have deep sleep and REM sleep, and you go through that maybe five times a night, and each time you will go through all of the stages, including your deep sleep and your REM sleep, and they all have different benefits. And what's interesting is in the beginning of the night, you have much more deep sleep and a little bit of REM sleep, and then towards the morning, you get much less deep sleep and more REM sleep. So if you go to bed really late or if you wake up too early, you're cheating yourself of one or the other. So you can't cheat the system, in other words, and this applies to teenagers, for example, because they have a later, their body clock changes when they're teenagers and they have to go to sleep naturally. They should be going to sleep a bit later and sleeping in a bit later. And so having to get up for school early is really affecting their REM sleep more than anything else.
There's been studies done on that.
Yeah, and the REM sleep is – what happens in REM sleep is that the brain resets your mood, your hormones and your mood – sort of resets your mood and restores your – all of those hormones and chemicals, which I can't really elucidate what they are, but it affects your mood. And so then you wonder why you have so many teenagers suffering from anxiety, from depression and stress and all of those things, because they're often getting up too early. And he's a big advocate for high school starting a bit later. Yeah. And I know Adelaide Botanic High School, which has just opened here in Adelaide and – so has a more innovative approach, perhaps, starts at 9:30.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's instead based on this science, do you think?
I think so, yeah. Yes.
Oh, interesting.
And that's a simple thing. But so that's an example of when you understand the sleep cycle, one thing leads to another, and then you want to make sure not just that you go to bed early, but you're getting all of those stages of sleep. And the deep sleep, which is the one a lot of people focus on, is – so important for so many reasons as well, and it washes the brain of all the byproducts from the learning of the day, and it helps you store your memories, and then it sort of clears the brain so that you're ready to learn something new the next day. And that's why you literally wake up feeling clear-headed, because the cerebral spinal fluid has done a wash through, and he describes it much better than I can, but all of that is so important. And he says you can't get that by going to bed at 1 a.m. and then sleeping till midday, because this happens before midnight or, you know, in the early stages of the night. And the circadian rhythm that, you know, dictates when it happens does not change. So you can't sort of catch up in that
Which
sense.
Is why it's very difficult for shift workers.
Yes. And he does talk about shift workers as well. And, you know, there are other things about the immune system. And so one of the processes that happens is that they're still discovering how and why and doing the science about it. But he gives the example in the immune system case of how it resets or recharges or feeds your antibodies. And so they've done studies about if you have a flu vaccine and you've had a few nights of five hours or less of sleep, and then you have a flu vaccine, your antibodies won't take up the vaccine.
Oh,
and so there's no point having it. Whereas if you've had a week of good sleep, then the flu vaccine will be effective. And so that's, again, just an example of where you could – he sort of proposes that you could have an app if it's done with privacy in mind and all of that, where the doctors can let you know that, you know, you're tracking your sleep, and they can say, come in for the flu vaccine, or can, you know, you might as well postpone it because it won't take. But just the illustrating the point of how much sleep interacts with our, you know, provides us with that immunity or doesn't, as the case may be. And then there's the appetite, how it restores your hormones that are linked to appetite. So when we're tired, we crave more food and we crave unhealthy food. And they've done studies. So again, it's all backed up now with studies. But we sort of, you know, you might know that intuitively.
But there is actually a biological reason for it.
Then he explains why that happens. Mm. And caffeine, so yes, so let's talk about caffeine.
Caffeine. Well, I think if I remember correctly, he doesn't advocate giving up coffee, does he,
Adam? No.
No, but just cutting back. And what the two things I changed when I read this book, one was cutting back on coffee. I would be sometimes having four coffees a day. And there are some studies that say, look, that's okay. It may be, except if it interferes with your sleep. And I find if I have coffee after midday, it does. So I try and, as much as possible, never have coffee after midday.
Mm.
And the other thing he says, if he explains everything, as Anna says, but then he gives some very practical advice, which is good too.
Yes, I love the practical
and
tips.
So if you want to cut to the chase, the appendix at the end has the 12 tips. But probably the most important thing he says, if you were to do only one thing to improve your sleep, that would be going to bed and waking up at the same time every day, no matter what. So that's interesting. Of course, in a real world, that can sometimes be difficult.
It's really hard to do.
I think you can do that as much as possible. And I try and do that now after reading this book.
Yeah. So what has changed for me is that I still have my coffee in the morning, but I'm trying to have it earlier, because he talks about the half-life of 8 hours and the quarter life of 12 hours. So it's like having a quarter of a cup of coffee at midnight if you've had a coffee at midday, for example. So I've actively tried to just push it a bit earlier in the day. He does talk about people who have a coffee after dinner and say they can still fall asleep, which they can, but he says the sleep quality will be affected, even though they're asleep, so they might not realise. And the other thing is the circadian rhythm. So the way to optimise your sleep is if your circadian rhythm is really activated, which means going outside in the morning. And so he says not to wear sunglasses. Mm. So I've become this no sunglasses in the morning to get the sunlight into your eyes.
Natural light it has to be, artificial light.
Yes, because he said with the artificial light, we're sort of living on a dimmer switch in terms of the message our brain gets about when it's time to be awake and when it's time to be asleep. And then at night time, he says, turn off half the lights in your house about an hour before you go to bed. And that's a really simple thing that anyone can do, that it does actually start to make you feel a little bit sleepy in a good way, and prepares your brain for the fact that you're now going to sleep. So they are really easy tips, but I highly recommend reading this. It has changed my habits and I never quite get the sleep that I'm still aiming for, but it's so important.
Especially not during the festival.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's why, in fact, lockdown has been a time where we can go to, you know, we can at least work out our bedtimes because we're not out every night. So that's been quite refreshing in a way. But look, that's enough, because I could go on and on. But Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker, highly recommend. And Amanda, you've got another one on this area.
Yes, I'll just quickly mention this one. This is more about rest than sleep, and it's The Miracle of Mindfulness, which probably a lot of people have heard of. It's by the Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh. He was born in Vietnam and then exiled and has lived most of his life in France, where he founded the Plum Village, which is a meditation retreat and school. Anyway, he's written, I think, it could be over 100 books. He's prolific. And this is one of his kind of famous seminal books. And one thing he says in this book that really resonated with me is he talks about why you should meditate. And he says, first of all, because each of us needs to realize total rest. He says even a night of sleep doesn't provide total rest. So, you know, I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, he just talks about the benefit of rest and how that's so important for you to quieten your mind down and just bring yourself back to your center So that's really all I'll say about that book. But
it is fascinating how we don't do that. And this, I've noticed this recently because I've had an eye thing where I've been recommended to wear a heat pack on my eyes. And to do that, you have basically heat up the heat pack, lie down for 5 minutes with the heat pack on your eyes, which sounds so easy. And it's really hard to find the time to lie down and do nothing for 5 minutes. And so I've become acutely aware of how little we stop in the day because I've sort of had to do it. And it is restful, but it's a discipline, isn't it?
Yeah, and he gives in the book too, he gives some really practical advice, which I follow. And one of them is do the dishes to do the dishes. So when you're actually doing the dishes or any kind of what you might consider in quotes menial task, just focus on the task at hand. Don't resent doing them. Don't think, oh, when I finish this, I'll do such and such. Just surrender to the chore at hand and be present. So I really like that.
Yeah, that's good. So now we're all rested and we're all about our sleep. But then one area that I think we all enjoy learning about is exercise and movement. And Amanda is also, apart from being having the master's in nutrition, Amanda is quite an expert in this, having done some triathlons. She's very modest about it. She won't say
she's
this.
She's overselling it.
And a half Ironman last year, was it?
Yes.
So quite, so Amanda comes to this with actual expertise in terms of having done the training and gone into that world of exercise. But we've got a couple of really sort of iconic books, I think. And one is Born to Run by Christopher McDougall, which I've had on my shelf for a couple of years and I've been meaning to read. And again, it's the same old story. I haven't quite got to it. But Amanda, you can sell me on this book.
Yeah, look, the reason I put this on my list of books about running is because apart from anything else, it's just a really interesting story. So the way it evolves is that Christopher McDougall, who's a journalist and a very keen runner, has a sore foot and he thinks, why did this happen and what causes it? And so he goes into this sort of rabbit hole, I guess, of looking at the biomechanics of running, and he comes across the Tarahumara indigenous people in Mexico who run in sandals, and they can run for 100 kilometers and just keep going, and running is part of their life and culture. So he goes and lives with these people for a while to try and understand more about running. And incidentally, this book sort of was the thing that kicked off that whole barefoot running debate with the Vibram Five Fingers. And so that's sort of an interesting area, and I won't delve into that because people have different opinions about that. And, you know, someone from a shoe company is going to say, well, it's bad for you. And I tried it, I must admit, but I went back to shoes because I prefer running on trails and it's protective. You know, he looks back at humans and how we evolved to run. And, for example, humans would chase down animals and they'd run for ages to exhaust the animal and isolate them from the herd, and that's how they ended up being able to kill the animal. And so running is part of the way humans are meant to move.
Yes.
And basically, I think he has to go and find this isolated tribe in the modern world to look at how that actually is done. And then part of the reason the book is fun to read is because he collects together this kind of ragtag group of people, and they stage a 50-mile race through this the Copper Canyon in Mexico.
Oh my
gosh.
So
he sort of pits the locals against these, interesting ultra endurance runners, and it's just entertaining.
Oh, wow.
So yes, I would definitely, if you want to read about running but in an entertaining and not dry way, this is a really good one to read.
And is it inspiring? Does it make you want to go running?
Well, it certainly was for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I love books. You should see my running shelf, and I've got about 40 books about running. I love it. And
so it was hard to cut down, actually, for this episode.
Oh, it was. So I tried to pick books that gave something to me and that I thought were also entertaining, because there's so many books about running, you know, how to run a marathon and various plans and whatnot. They're a dime a dozen, really. Mm. And they can be good too. The next one that I really liked is, it's been around for quite some time, and it's called Chi Running by Danny Dreyer. And the reason I love this book is he combines Tai Chi and running. And so he talks about how to run without becoming injured. And the sort of dominant paradigm for running has usually been about strengthening your legs and being strong and driving with your legs. Whereas he sort of looks at it from a different angle and talks about loosening up and moving your muscles and relaxing and using your mind. And he talks about the way you position your body when you run, in that you should use gravity to help you. So you sort of lean forward, not bending forward from your waist, but you lean your whole body forward a bit, which sort of you know, makes you feel like you want to fall, and that's using the gravity. And he also talks about the benefits of landing midfoot. And again, that's an area which people can debate for, you know, until the cows come home about.
Yeah.
Some people say you shouldn't tamper with your natural running stride at all, and others say it's more efficient to land midfoot. But in any event, I really like this book because it was interesting to read about the mechanics of running.
Yeah.
And I have actually adopted that style, where I try and lean forward a bit more, and I am a midfoot striker now.
Wow. So it wasn't hard to – well, it was doable to
absolutely
change.
Yeah. Doable, because it's – you know, a lot of it's in your mind. If you're very aware of how you you place your body when you run, you know, I didn't find it difficult. And he says it'll stop you getting injured, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, it's an interesting book to read, and I really like the way he talks about Tai Chi and how using your mind is just as important.
Yeah, that's good. And it's always interesting when someone can cover more than one genre or more than one area of expertise, isn't it? And they can synthesize different disciplines.
Yeah. So that's a good one. And it has been around, I think it was published in 2004. So it's been around for a while.
Mm.
And then anyone who knows me knows that I am obsessed with Rich Roll.
How funny.
I listen to his podcast religiously.
Mm.
And his book is called Finding Ultra: Rejecting Middle Age, Becoming One of the World's Fittest Men, and Discovering Myself. So Rich Roll is now a very successful podcaster, but basically when he was about to turn 40, he was overweight, he was an alcoholic, he was, needless to say, unhealthy.
Mm.
Basically, he had this light bulb moment where he was struggling to go up the stairs, and he thought, oh my gosh, what has my life become?
Yeah.
And through years of hard work and dedication and going to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's something he's very open about it, actually. I think you have to deal with it every single day.
I think
it's
that's
not
right.
Like you just
They don't ever say they're cured.
No,
as
they're
such.
Recovered, it's but it's an
recovering,
ongoing.
I think.
Yes, yeah, an recovering. Ongoing challenge. Mm. But as part of that, he changed up his diet. He's very into being a vegan, to the point that he can be a little bit evangelical about it, but still very interesting. But the thing I really love is how he became an ultra endurance athlete. And he's done a lot of things, but in this book he talks about, he did two amazing things. The Ultraman, which is a bit like an Ironman on steroids.
Oh my gosh.
It's a 320-mile race. And he he also did a thing called the Epic, which is five Ironman distance triathlons, each on a different Hawaiian island in less than a week. So no, it's pretty amazing.
I'm just shaking my head at this point. I can't even imagine.
But this again is
I mean, you work up to it though. It's not – you just don't suddenly do that.
He's obviously got the right physique. He was a college swimmer, so he had a you know, base level of high fitness.
Yeah.
But the reason I love this book, it is a lot about running and triathlon, but it's also a very personal journey. And he's a fascinating guy. He's really overcome some massive obstacles. And I just love the way it's like you're sitting down having a chat with him. Yeah. I found this book so inspiring. Loved
it. Wow. Mm. Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. It is a good podcast. I haven't listened to too many episodes, but he's a really engaging and intelligent host. So.
He's fabulous. Yeah.
Oh, very good. Mm. So we're all up and moving now. We are now turning to mental health and social connection. And there are just so many books we could be talking about. And there's one I'll mention, but I can't tell you anything about it that's not on our list. But it's called Aristotle's Way by Edith Hall. And she talks about how to live a good life, but referencing Aristotle.
Oh, wonderful.
And Natalie Haynes recommended this when I interviewed her about her fabulous book, A Thousand Ships. And Natalie Haynes is very well versed in Greek mythology. And she has done a podcast with Edith Hall and recommended Aristotle's Way. And my husband read it and said it was fantastic.
Oh, really?
And really readable. Mm. So it is about, in terms of how to live a good life, you know, being a little bit philosophical. So I can only mention it. I can't tell you much more, but that was just my one that's on my TBR. But Amanda, you've got some great recommendations here.
Yes. Mm. So the first one is How to Live a Good Life by Jonathan Fields. He also has a podcast if you're interested. And basically, I like this book because it's a really practical, it's like a manual, in fact. And the way he describes living a good life is he says that we have three buckets. And in order to live a good life, those buckets should be full. And the first one is vitality, which is about our state of mind and our body. The second one is connection, which is about our relationships. And the third is contribution and how you contribute to the world. And for each bucket, he's got 10 chapters, so 30 in total. And he has a little explanation or exercise, something you can do every day or you can just for 30 days or just pick the ones that you're interested in. It shows how a lot of things overlap. So, for example, in his vitality bucket, he looks at sleep as one of the foundations for our health.
Say no more.
Yeah, exactly. In the connection bucket, he has a chapter about being disciplined about the time we spend on things like our phones. And, you know, for example, he suggests when we're having meals, put the phone in a different room.
Yes, that's a great idea.
Yeah. So just very simple things but effective. And in the connection bucket, he talks about, for example, work out what matters to you and then base your decisions on that. And really what he's getting at there is a way of saying no to things.
Yes.
You know, sometimes we feel like we're pulled in all sorts of different directions and we end up saying yes to things that perhaps we shouldn't because we don't have enough time or it's keeping us away from things that we love to do. So this is, I think this is a really practical.
That sounds excellent.
Yeah, it's really good actually.
I think I'll have to add that to my
list
as well.
I really enjoyed this book.
And the next one sounds really intriguing. Oh. Quiet by Susan Cain.
Well, Quiet by Susan Cain probably had the effect on me that Matthew Walker's Why We Sleep had on you, Anna.
Oh. So here we go.
Just in a nutshell, it was quite a while ago that I read this book. But what she does is she looks at introverts and extroverts. And in the very beginning of the book, there's a little quiz that you take.
Right.
Have you read this one, Anna?
No.
And it basically, you answer this quiz and you work out whether you're an introvert or an extrovert. And most people obviously fall somewhere on that scale.
Yeah.
And apparently about a third of the people in the world are introverts. And I was surprised. I was 100% introvert.
Wow.
And that That doesn't mean you're shy. I think that's a misconception. It's all about where you get your energy from. So an extrovert feels energized and gets joy and happiness from, say, being in with their friends and socializing. Mm. An introvert can also enjoy those things, which I do, but needs to have solitude to recharge. So it's really about where, how you get your energy. And the reason this is important is because, certainly in the US, the world is kind of set up for extroverts.
Oh, yes.
And so definitely, if you don't fall into that category, sometimes it can be really challenging. And when I read this book, it was like a light bulb going off for me. I thought, oh, now I understand myself a bit more. And instead of sort of beating yourself up and thinking you're not,
you have to go out to this function, you're not
as socially active as other people, and what's wrong with me? It just made me allow myself to enjoy that solitude and not feel guilty about it.
Oh, good. So this, well, you shouldn't feel guilty about it. But yes, I know what you mean. The world is so set up for extroverts, and even the example of authors. And authors are a classic case of people who, by and large, you could never generalize, but it suits an introvert personality. And obviously some authors are introverts, certainly not all of them. But you just look at trying to sell a book and how effective it is when you have an author who is also, and this, they could still be an introvert and be good at this, but who is also enjoys being on stage, loves giving an interview, enjoys the publicity, loves meeting their readers, and how many books that can sell. And it's really set up for extroverts.
It absolutely is. So the introvert author in general will have to learn those skills.
Yes.
Just because you're an introvert doesn't mean you can't do it.
No, of course.
It's just, it's more like you sort of have to make yourself do it a bit.
Exactly.
But then that's okay. Yeah. You go back home to a quiet room and just relax.
Recharge.
Yeah.
Yeah. How interesting.
Yeah, if you suspect you may be an introvert, anyone listening, I really highly recommend this book, Quiet by Susan Cain.
So very empowering.
Very much so. Lost Connections by Johan Hari. Have you read this one, Anna?
No, but I heard him speak. Yes. And this is an example, actually, of where an author, you know, when they're also a fabulous speaker. I heard him speak in Adelaide at a Writers' Week out of season event. So he came to Adelaide and spoke at Elder Hall, I think it was. And he's a fabulous speaker. So I got all of the messages. I was completely hooked. And I think I bought the book and gave it to a friend. I don't think I've read it yet. It's all about the epidemic of loneliness. Yes. And he talks, again, it's someone who has done the science and done the research and talks about the actual
And lived it as well.
So he's got an interesting personal story, but also can communicate that so clearly. And then he talks about how connecting and having a community is so important to treating depression. Yeah. And he worked that out himself by going on antidepressants and saying, well, why am I still not better, you know?
Exactly.
And there's just so many more pieces in the puzzle. And then he set about finding
elucidating them.
But it's really interesting and heartwarming as well.
Basically what he says in a nutshell is there are 9 causes of depression and anxiety, and they all stem from disconnection. So, for example, disconnection from other people, which is loneliness, as Anna mentioned. Disconnection from the natural world is another one, and disconnection from meaningful work. And then he goes through, so it's not all doom and gloom, he then goes through and talks about how to reconnect.
Yeah.
And what a huge impact that can have on your mental health. Because I think the medical dogma has basically been, oh, depression is an imbalance of a chemical imbalance in the brain. So if we give you this drug, it'll, you know, alter that a little bit and it'll help. But obviously it's more than that. As he says, it's about connection.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting. And then he gives some examples of communities where they've forged these connections.
Right.
And it's been really, I found it really heartwarming, lovely to listen to him speak about that. And it gives you hope. And again, it's something that applies. You don't have to be depressed to get something out of this book, I think, yeah, because it's something we could all improve on, and
absolutely
any one of us, I'm sure, could be fostering our connections better, including with the natural world. That's a good example.
And, well, the other thing he talks about too, which would probably resonate with a lot of people, and you don't need to be depressed to understand this, he talks about junk values and how the culture that we live in is quite materialistic, and people are striving for exterior things to make themselves feel valued and happy, and how that in reality is not a cause for happiness or connection. So, you know, he makes some astute and interesting observations about life and the way we live it.
Yes, no, very dynamic guy. And
as you say, an excellent talker.
Yes, excellent speaker. So look up, if you can't find the book, look up his TED talk as well, because he's someone who is in that generation where he's completely adapted to the TED era, if you like, and has done that very effectively. And I think you even had another one that sounds fantastic, Amanda, which I, again, haven't read, but I feel like I'm late to the party with this one. The Book of Joy by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Yeah, this is one of my all-time favourite books. And the great thing about this book, I think, is like non-fiction, many non-fiction, you can dip in and out of it. And what it is, it's a meeting set up between the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu at the Dalai Lama's home to celebrate his 80th birthday. And Douglas Abrams is the journalist who's there facilitating the conversation. And I think it goes for about 4 or 5 days from memory. And on each day they talk about different things. So they'll talk about joy and happiness and mindfulness and, you know, how to find joy in the face of suffering. And these two men are obviously very good examples of that, because the Dalai Lama has been exiled from his homeland since 1959. The thing that's so delightful about these two men is that they have this abounding compassion for other people, and they talk together with so much love. It comes through in the book, and it is the ultimate feel-good book.
Yes.
It sort of gives you some hope in humanity.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah. And, of course, they talk about the peace of mind and inner values, and like Johann Hari said in his book, not being attached to materialistic things, and, you know, just all the lovely lessons we get from Buddhism.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. Oh, that sounds really good. I'm going to add that to my list as well. And there was another one that I loved the sound of, Amanda, Apples for the Mind by Tom Neamy.
Oh, yes. So Tom Neamy is an Adelaide person. And what he's done is this topic of his PhD research, he's a psychologist, is looking at mental resilience, because he thought, you know, he's talking mainly about young people. We learn about, you know, looking after our body through exercise and what we eat, but how do we look after our mind? How is the best way? So he has done a lot of research into resilience, and he has a program that he teaches in schools, and it's really excellent and very practical. And just for an example, one of the things he does, which I think is an excellent exercise for teenage children, is to look at images in advertising campaigns and social media and to unpick them.
Right.
And look at all the work that's gone into, I think there's quite a famous Dove ad campaign where they peel back all the layers, you know, they take away the makeup, they take away the lighting.
And
so you get the original person and how they look with none of those enhancements and then the final product. So he teaches children and young adults how to be very critical consumers of media.
Yeah, that's so important.
It's so important, because if you're always bombarded by unrealistic images, then the effect of that can be that you never feel like you're good enough.
Yes.
So yes, so I think as a parent, I would say, I mean, it's good for adults to read this book as well, but I think if you're a parent of a young child or a teenager, it's just got some really practical lessons in there.
Yeah, great. Well, that sounds really good. That's Apples for the Mind by Tom Neamy. And this is, as I said, very hard to narrow down to 12 books or thereabouts, but we would love to know your recommendations for any books to do with well-being. I think it's always good to have a list of, you know, things that you can go to, and again, focusing on different areas, but they're all important. Mm. So that's been fun to do. Thank you, Amanda, because Amanda had most of these recommendations. So,
oh, thank you, Anna. It was my pleasure. I love this kind of stuff.
So as I said, we could keep going all day, couldn't we? But yeah, that's it from us. So we'll be back next week with the next book that Amanda and I are reading, I think, is Simon the Fiddler by yes. Paulette Giles, which I'm looking forward to. And in the meantime, you can follow us on Facebook at Books on the Go or email us at booksonthegopodcast@gmail.com with any of your recommendations. And or if you've read any of these books, let us know what you thought. And I'm on Instagram, Twitter and Litzy at A. Bailey Karras. And Amanda?
I'm on Instagram at AmandaLHayes99.
Great. We'll see you soon. Bye for now.
Bye.